was going to make him stand. I always wanted to give a sermon while everyone was standing. For some reason, that just sounds epic. Something that I wanted to say last Sunday, and now I have the time to say it this Sunday, is in light of kind of the elders and leadership and the announcement of kind of the transition of Dave and his retirement, just so everyone knows, I mean, if you've been here, Dave's been here, it'll be for 29 years. That is a long time to be in ministry. That's a long time to be in any job. And the transition, we understand, is going to be difficult. It's going to be, there's going to be a lot of growth that's going to need to happen in me, in our leadership, because Dave has done and is doing a lot for this, for God, and for this congregation. And so I want to first tell you, we are using this word team. We want a team, a ministry team, two people to share the pulpit, to share the ministries of this congregation. And if you're asking what that looks like, you've actually have already been seeing that in action for the last couple of years, that Dave and I have been working as a team, not only just to bring you the lessons, but also to bring you the ministries that you've seen. This isn't just me coming up with all of this crazy stuff. You can blame that on Dave. A lot of this is Dave. This is a lot of it's through what God is doing in his leadership. A lot of what you see even me do as far as mentoring the young adults, that is merely replicating and building on what Dave had been doing for years before I got here. And so we're not even promoting anything really new. It's something that we've been doing since I've been here. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to come and work with you, is because a minister had been here and was offering mentorship and was offering discipleship of me. Coming as an associate here, that was one of the biggest selling points. Because if you've ever known young ministers, and I've known many because I am one, all my friends are, there's a lot of growth that needs to happen within those first years of developing a relationship with a church that's supposed to last for decades. I do want to say, Dave's relationship with you and this congregation, that should be the normal, but it isn't. Most ministers stay for 2 to 5 years, and then they head to the next church. Most of you who know ministers know that is most likely the case of what happens. I don't want to be that minister. I don't want to be the minister who's here for 5 years and then leaves for another church because they aren't sick of me yet. I want to stay here because you guys are already sick of me. You guys are already not impressed by my gifts and strengths, and yet you guys hopefully still want me here, and I want to be here. That's what I want to tell you. Nallie and I, we love it here. We love it here in Ventura. We love it here at this congregation. We love working here. We love working alongside you. We find your young adults to be pleasant, if not okay. We love those guys. We love having them in our houses on Tuesdays. I love meeting with them throughout the week over coffee, over food. We just love this. It's one of those situations I find myself that the fact I get to call this a job almost feels like I'm cheating because I love what I do. And I just want to tell you guys that as we go through this process, we want to be here. And hopefully you guys feel the same about us as well. And if not, come talk to me in truth and love, which is what we're talking about this morning. We are continuing this idea of speaking to each other in truth, in love. Last Sunday, we kind of had this framework. We tried to build this framework of using divine examples, using Jesus's conversations with others to kind of build this idea of how we should talk to each other, specifically when the truth may be perceived as insulting or harsh. Maybe you have a friend whose life is going down the wrong road, and you feel that God has placed it in your heart to confront that person with a certain truth or a certain idea. Or maybe you feel that God is telling you to hit them upside the head and tell them to stop. And that can be perceived as harsh. They might not like hearing what you have to say. And God and Jesus gives us many examples of what that might look like. That first, we need to recognize our audience. We need to recognize our surroundings, who we're talking to, where we are talking to them. Are we on the college campus? Are we in our homes? Are we in their homes? Are they a mature Christian or maybe an immature Christian? Maybe they're new to the faith, or maybe they're not a Christian at all. So we have to be aware of our surroundings. And then we also have to pick our battles, meaning that there are things that you're going to see in their life that you want to attack. You want to tell them what they're doing is wrong. But you might be sidetracked by all the little tiny habits they have, maybe the words they use. And so we need to pick our battles. Jesus is confronted with many horrible sinners. But if you notice as how he talks to them, he chooses his battles wisely. Instead of confronting or bringing up their sin, which they already know, Jesus instead offers forgiveness, grace, and mercy. Instead of attacking them or making them feel bad or trying to make them feel guilty, he sometimes uses grace. Other times, he does use guilt. Other times, he does use shame. But that is also Jesus knowing who he's talking to. To those people he usually is using guilt or using shame to change, they are more often than not the religious elite. They're the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the arrogant, the ones who think they do not need God because they have all the understanding themselves. So we need to choose our battles wisely. And we also need to be honest. We need to be honest with ourselves about our sin, about where we're coming from. And we need to be honest with the people we're talking to. And we can't be dishonest because that gives people the impression that we're signing on to their lifestyle, that we're signing on to what they feel is correct for them. And that's not the case. That's not what Jesus calls us to do. Jesus is very confrontational with people, very honest, to the point where we get this impression Jesus doesn't really care about feelings. He doesn't care about how we feel. He can be very insulting at times by telling people exactly how things are. We look at how Jesus talks to Peter over and over and over again. You have little faith, the person who jumped out of the boat and walked on water to Jesus. You didn't understand any of this. He calls Peter Satan. You don't understand the ways of God. That is very honest, brutally honest. And so we have to be honest with people. We have to tell them what Jesus actually says, and we can't shy away from that because Jesus says some pretty controversial stuff. And especially in our culture, with this generation, the things that come out of Jesus' mouth, especially when he denounces sin, is downright insulting to this generation, to people like me. It can be very insulting to us, but we need to be honest. And then finally, we need to have an end game in mind. We need to have an idea of where we want to end this conversation. We want them to gather a view of God that is both gracious, but is also judgmental, that this is God the Father we're talking about here, and he has certain ways of viewing reality that we cannot move or alter or sugarcoat. And so we need to have an end in mind. How do we want these people to view Jesus, to view God, to view the church, and to view me through this conversation? And I'm going to use this word, intentional. We're going to talk about that more, but I kind of want to bring you to where we were at the end of last Sunday. But there was something I left out, and I left out because we were running late on time, and you guys were all looking at me like I was an enchilada, and I got the impression you were all hungry, so I wanted to end it as soon as possible, or else you guys would start rioting. But there was a big part I left out, and what was amazing is, I was wondering kind of if anybody would bring this up at the end of it, especially since I gave most of my lesson, or most of the attention on the lesson about being honest with each other. And so finally, a sweet sister came up to me after church and said, "Joe, that was a great lesson," which I disagreed with her on. And she goes, "But there's one thing. What if it doesn't work?" And I thought, yes. Yes, you have a question for me. Something I left out. Something that I meant to put in there but didn't. All right, what if we use this framework? What if we talk to each other in truth and love? We recognize who we're talking to, where we're talking to them at. We choose our battle wisely. We are honest with them as we are honest with each other. And we also want them to come to a better relationship with God after that conversation. And we still have the conversation. But at the very end, they still don't understand. They still don't want to hear what you have to say. How do we speak powerful words to people that it just doesn't seem to work with them? And often this is family members, people that you're close to, people that you care about. During one of my classes at Sunset, a minister or a professor came up and he was talking about the wrath of God, specifically in the Old Testament and in Revelation. And he said, "Do you notice something about when it comes to wrath, especially the wrath of God? God usually only has wrath for things he cares about, concerning things he cares about. When he talks about clearing away nations for the sake of Israel, he uses that with a cup of wrath being filled and then being poured out in order to solve a dilemma or solve an issue concerning Israel. And that's usually true with us. Now, we have wrath for things that we care about. We get angry over things that we care about. When our opinions or our views or our children or our family are concerned, we can find ourselves getting very angry, and that is natural. But what happens when it doesn't work? See, I want us to kind of come together on this because I want to go back to Jesus. Even though Jesus can seem like a rough example to use because Jesus is perfect. Jesus is God in flesh, but I love using him as an example in this case because even Jesus didn't have 100% on this. See, with all the love and the truth in the world at his disposal, Jesus himself still had people leave him. Right? People that had wanted nothing to do with him. Jesus miraculously healed people, and then they didn't want anything to do with him. Jesus didn't even have a perfect track record when it came to speaking the truth in love to people he cared about, and then still keeping them in a relationship. So I have to ask you this, as we dive into the rest of this lesson, I have to ask, the speaking this truth in love, especially speaking powerfully, because that is what we want. That's where we're going to, right? We want to speak powerfully into people's life. We want to incur change. We want to develop a relationship, not just between us, but between them and God. So I have to ask you, are you trying to change them? Or are you trying to love them? Or are you trying to shame them? Are you trying to guilt them? What is your intention when you do this? When you finally gather the courage to speak to them, and as you are equipped with all the framework, with all the gifts and all the strength and all the tools that God can muster, what is your intention? Are you just trying to love them? Or are you just trying to change them? Another wise man once told me that maturity is defined by people who never get their way, and that immaturity is defined by people who always get what they want. We notice this by how we speak to one another, because we want instant change. That is what we are going for, usually when we speak to one another. We want change. And again, I'm going back, I'm defaulting on this when we speak maybe harsh truths to one another. We want change immediately. We want them to hear what we're saying, and then we want them to change colors. We want them to, maybe we want something physical to change about them so that not only they understood, but they retained what we said, and they will actually do something different with what I said because of what I said. And that doesn't work too often. That very rarely works. See, God is so intimately familiar with this problem that we have a wealth of Old Testament stories to look at for education. We see this so often. That's what we're going to within the Old Testament. If you have your Bibles, start right now. It's in we're going to be in 1 Kings chapter 19. Yeah, it's buried in the Old Testament. It's on page 360 in my Bible. It's back there. Because I can't help but think this idea of, man, what do we do when people don't want to hear what we have to say? I think of watching, any competition shows. And for some reason, in our family, we end up watching a lot of them. My wife loves to sing, so we end up watching tons of singing competition shows. And inevitably, on every single season of one of those shows, there will come a person who gets up and has got the courage to sing in front of a group of people, in front of a crowd, and they are absolutely awful. They bomb. And that's usually why we actually watch those shows, because we want to see those people bomb. We want to see them do horribly and see the judges react to them doing horribly. And I love it because sometimes when the judges criticize the contestant for how horrible they are, the contestant will take it and say, yes, that's constructive. That's all. Thank you for what you have to say. I recognize you're a professional in this field. I want to be a professional. I'll take that and leave. But those aren't the fun contestants, right? It's the contestants where the judges criticize them and they reply back, you don't know what you're talking about. Right? Like, you don't know how to sing. You don't know me. I can sing beautifully. It's like, no, you can't. You sound like someone's running over a squirrel. No, you can't sing at all. But they don't recognize the criticism. They don't recognize that truth when it's spoken to them. And we can fall into very similar holes. We can fall into very similar areas. I remember as becoming a minister, is the idea of, I started out with an internship. I interned with two churches. Before I decided to take the leap into ministry. And I remember the first criticism I received. I remember that first truth in love. And it was well deserved. I deserved that truth. It was how I was speaking. It was how I was presenting myself. And the person came up to me. It was an older member. And I loved what they had to say. They corrected me. They revealed that truth. And I came away offended. And I came away angry at them, thinking they didn't know. They don't know me. They don't know. They don't have no clue as to me. And I wanted to at first reject that truth. But Eli, my mentor at the time, as I was, you know, crying and telling him how bad this person was to me, Eli's response was something that carried with me for the rest of my ministry, for the rest of my life. He said, "You're going to hear truth, and you may not like everything you hear. And sometimes it may be wrong, and other times it might be true. But they deserve the right to be heard. They deserve the right to be heard," meaning that you need to look and find the truth in that. You need to be mature and understand that sometimes people are going to say things you may not want to hear. So how did God do this? How did God handle people who were so thick-skulled? How did God handle people whom he constantly dived into a relationship with them, telling them the truth, telling him what he wanted, and yet they didn't want to take his advice. They didn't want to take his criticism. They didn't want to take his truth. And I love this story. It's in 1 Kings chapter 19. It's the story of Elijah. And many of you are familiar with this. But Elijah is like me. I think Elijah is a lot like all of us at times. When we confront God with complaints or issues, God seems to treat us in very similar ways. So we'll start in verse 1. Ahab, the king at the time, told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed, that's Ahab, had killed all of the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." And that's a fancy way to put a death threat, all right? Jezebel is telling Elijah, "I'm going to kill you," all right? That is what her intention is. That is what she wants to do. Verse 3, "Then he was afraid, and he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, 'It is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my father's.' And he lay down and he slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, 'Arise and eat.' And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank, and he lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time, touched him, and said, 'Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you.' And he arose, and he ate, and he drank. And he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God." So we're introduced to this idea, this personality of Elijah. And he has a complaint. He has something to bring before God. And we can look at this and say, "Aren't you being a little dramatic? Where's your faith? Where's your trust?" But his complaint is very similar to what Job's complaint was. Everything is going wrong. All of my friends have died. Ahab and Jezebel have done a really great job in killing your prophets, the people that you send to them. And they're slaughtering them wholesale. He feels like he's the only one left. And so when he is confronted by this, God's response is not an immediate answer. I love this. God's response isn't just to fix the problem. He tells Elijah, "You're about to go on a journey." And God is preparing the soil. God is preparing Elijah for eventually what he will say, but Elijah doesn't understand that. Imagine if you went to your friend saying, "My life is in chaos," and the response is, "Go fuel up your car, you're heading to Oklahoma." How would you respond to that? Can you fix that now? Why do I have to go anywhere? Why do I have to travel anywhere, God? There seems to be a problem. Why can't you fix that here? And so this is what happens, picking up back in verse 9. "There he came to a cave, and he lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?' He said, 'I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I, only am left, and they seek my life to take it away.' He said, go out and stand at the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. I love this because as a parent, I didn't know that this was possible. Have you ever gotten so mad, so angry at something? Maybe it's something your children did, or maybe it's something else. You've gotten so angry, you've yelled, you've expressed your anger, but you just get angrier. And finally, you reach a breaking point. And this was, I've seen this in a lot of parents, that you can't yell anymore. Maybe your voice is destroyed. So then you get so mad, you almost break yourself and you whisper. Remember it being as a kid when your parents got so mad they had to whisper to you? Right? Maybe you were at church or something like that and they looked at you and they said, stop it. Right? You guys know what I'm talking about? At that point as a child, you almost wish your parents would yell at you because then you would at least get witnesses who would look at what your parents are about to do. Right? You ever get that like really hard tap on the back of the head? But it was like this really restrained tap. It was almost worse than a slap on the back of the head. It was like this really big poke on the back of the head. And you're like, what the? You know, you look back and your mom is, stop it now. Right? They whisper. See, I've always read this story, and I've always been presented this story as God is frustrated. So a windstorm, an earthquake, fire, all of this. And then God gets real with a whisper. What are you doing here? What is wrong with you? What is this complaint you keep bringing to me? Look at how God responds to this. In verse 13, and when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak, and he went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there was a voice to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? He said, I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even only I, am I left, and they seek my life to take it away. It's the same complaint. I find this very interesting as to why God is asking Elijah why he thinks he's here. Elijah's response seems to be, it's because I'm the only one you have left. And what are you doing here? But that answer doesn't seem to match the question that God keeps asking him. I love this. God, I'm the only one here. God's response, go on a journey. I am preparing you for the answer. Finally, Elijah gets to the mountain. God asks him, why are you here? Did you not learn it on the journey here? Did you not find that answer within yourself? Apparently you didn't. Go in the cave, Elijah. So Elijah goes in the cave, I imagine expecting the answer there. Because that's why God tells him, go in that cave. And so we find these expressions of God's anger, God's power, that as a prophet, you should be able to see God move in miraculous ways and at least surmise that God is more powerful than you are. But he comes out the other side hearing this whisper, knowing that God is in that whisper. And finally, God asks again, why are you here? Why are you here? Is your skull too thick? Is your heart too hard? What is wrong? Why can't you seem to understand the truth? And Elijah responds the same way. This is his third time, saying, I'm it. I am it. All of the prophets seem to be dying, and I seem to be the only one left. And what is God's response? Finally, God gets to the answer after preparing the soil through what I imagine God is wholly frustrated with Elijah. He finally responds to him saying, you think you're the only one? You're not the only one. I have 7,000 people who are not going to bow the knee to Baal. You're not the only one. Go back and do your job. Go back and do your job. Be my mouthpiece to the people of Israel. The one thing I notice with this interaction between God and Elijah is this word intention. Well, what is God intending here as God is preparing the soil, as God is repetitive with Elijah, and as Elijah is repetitive with God? See, at first, I'm attracted to this word intention because I use this a lot in my ministry. I'm currently now planning our fall advance. That's in November. And if you are a young adult, I hope you can come to that. And if you're not a young adult, you're more than welcome to come to that. I am using this word intention because it's a beautiful word. It's a word I hear a lot in ministry, that intentional ministry, meaning are you going about conversations with people intentionally, knowing what you're going to talk about and knowing where that conversation might go. But I love that one of the definitions for this word, that in medicine, it means the healing process of a wound. See, often we speak and we want immediate change. And we speak and we want people to snap to attention. When we say, hey, you are sinning, we want them to come to the realization then and there that they are a sinner, that they are guilty of sin, and they should feel shame for that sin. We want this. We want this because it makes our job easy. Instead, God gives us an example that isn't so easy, that is prolonged and laborious. That he looks to Elijah and says, no, this is going to be a process of change. This is going to be a process that's going to require you to suffer. It's going to be a process requiring you to hopefully see through that suffering that the answer is right in front of your face. See, look at this, what God makes Elijah do before he finally gives him this answer. Are you willing to take the time to be a part of the solution instead of just giving the solution? When you speak the truth in love, are you comfortable with God looking at you saying, you're going to be a piece of that truth? You're going to be the piece of truth that you just told them about. We work effectively when not only are we honest with each other, but that when we become a part of the solution, we are trying to promote amongst each other. When we look at someone and saying, I notice you're drinking too much. I notice you're smoking too much. I notice you're doing this. I notice you have a problem with pornography. I notice you have a problem with sin. There's nothing wrong with coming apart and telling them, I did too. I struggle too. I struggle in the same way. And when someone gave me that truth, I rejected it just like I see in your face you're about to do now. But I'm telling you, if you go down that road, I can tell you personally what waits for you down there. See, this is why I love, and I think we as a congregation need to work more closely with each other, is because we have young adults suffering very similar problems that you did when you were young. Now, just because they have the internet, just because they may be different, speak different, use different words, they need to hear from you what awaits them when they go down that road. They need to hear what alcoholism can do to a family, what it can do to a personal life. They need to hear what pornography, how that can damage a marriage. They need to hear what happens when two people who are married together fight and have conflict. Because right now, the only thing that's answering their questions is Google. They need to hear this from you. They need the truth from you. They need that intention, that process to heal a wound, because it's a wound. Elijah has a wound that he doesn't even recognize is there. And as God takes him along this journey, he finally reveals it to him. You're not alone. You've never been alone, and you'll never be alone. That is a part of that answer. The other part of that answer is, do your job. You are a prophet. You are a servant of God. And this is what makes the truth of Job so relevant, because Job goes before God with a very solid question of why this is happening. And he goes over and over and over 38 chapters of questioning God, saying, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And God's response is, do you even know who you are? Do you know who you are? Yes, you are suffering. Yes, you have no understanding of why you are suffering. But that isn't even the point. The point is, he's God and you're not. He's God and I am not. See, love is not always easy. And people are not always easy to love. But truth is more important than feelings. And love is best expressed when it has age and trial under its belt. That when you, an older member, befriends and cares for a younger person, the experience that you bring to that table. And I'm telling you, I came to a church, this church, with a wealth of history. hearing about the homes that you've opened up for the young adults. And when I came here, we had 25 young adults. Now we only got like 6. I don't know what happens. I blame Dave. But no, they all moved on. They all got jobs and married, and we did our job. We prepared them for life, and they, surprise, surprise, went out and got it. Love is not always easy, and people don't always want to hear the truth. But truth is more important than the feelings we are trying to promote, and love is best when it is aged. Love is best is when you spend the time and the effort, when you hear that first thing that you want to disconnect the relationship, but instead you say, the relationship is more important than my feelings or maybe my opinions or maybe more important than something else. I will hold on to this relationship. I will say this. I look at this row of older, beautiful ladies and the relationships that they have with one another. I'm blessed to be a part of their small group, and I hear the trials that they go through together, how they help one another through their situations. And I find a blessing in that, that my kids get to hear their lives. They hear how they help one another. It works best when we connect. I want you to notice the consistent truth that God is trying to get across Elijah. And I also have to appreciate in some way the consistent complaint of Elijah. So, and the way that I connect with this, where we're at now, is we have a generation of young adults whose complaint seems to be consistent. I am either not being heard, I don't feel respected, I don't feel connected, and I hear this over and over and over again. Last week we had a conference about millennials and how we can connect, 7 ways that we can connect with the next generation. And what I was surprised with that conference was I was not surprised with the truths, the point that he was getting across, that millennials, that young adults, people under the age of 35, feel a disconnect with the older generation. That is a consistent complaint that seems to keep coming up again and again and again. And Dave is a wealth of that information. Having been here for as long as he has, he hears that over and over and over again. But what I love about what God has been doing through this congregation is it has been connecting over and over again this multi-generation that we have represented here. That we have Doug, we have other young adults up here leading. We have other people leading side by side. One can be 80 and the other can be 18. And we see that over, and I want to promote that. That is a way to answer this very consistent problem this generation has. But never forget how God addresses this issue. He addresses this issue by really connecting Elijah's faith with his complaint. So I have to ask you, where is your hope and trust? When you are confronting somebody with truth and love and they don't want to hear what you have to say, that you with intention want to be a part of that process. And that is a hard process. It's a process that can take years, even decades. How do you find the longevity? How do you find that engine to sustain that relationship? And the answer is faith and hope. There's a story within the Old Testament. It is a beautiful story of a young woman who is put in a very specific place. And it's a story of Esther. And if you can, you could turn there. If not, I just want you to listen to this. It is a story of Esther, a beautiful story of someone who went from nothing to a queen. And it seems that she finds herself, by the time we're in Esther chapter 4, that a situation is developing in this nation. And it's a story of where one man wants to kill and destroy all of the Jews because he's trying to kill one specific man named Mordecai. And Mordecai is the uncle of Esther. And so Mordecai becomes aware of this plot to destroy all of the Jews. And so he goes to the one person whom he knows that can do something about it. And so he goes to Esther. And he finds himself at the gates of the court because he can't go inside. Because he's mourning, and the king doesn't want mourning people who are mourning, people who are grieving, in his court. He just wants to not see that. He doesn't want to be around it. And so from the gate, he calls out to Esther, and one of the eunuchs comes out on Esther's behalf and asks him what he is doing. And so we are in Esther chapter 4, and we're going to start in verse 11. And this is what Mordecai says. "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law, to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come to the king in these 30 days. I'm sorry, this isn't Mordecai. This is Esther's response to Mordecai. Verse 12. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. And when Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to this kingdom for such a time as this. So Esther's response to Mordecai would be very similar to our response to such dire times. And her response is, what if I die? What if I die? If you're familiar with the story of Esther, you know what happened to the previous queen. She spoke when she wasn't allowed to speak, and it cost her her life. She acted in a way that the king did not like, and so the king ended up having her killed. And so Esther's response is very appropriate, I believe. Her response is, if I speak right now, and I do not gain the permission to speak, I will suffer for this. And Mordecai's response is beautiful. It is to the point. His response is, don't you think God put you here for this exact reason? And this is the truth I want to get across to you. That when you speak the truth in love, that when you confront somebody with an issue that you see in their life, you have to believe that God has placed you there for that exact reason. That God put you there so that you can speak love and life, or that you can reveal sin for what it is, that you can reveal scripture for what it is. I believe that God has placed me here in Ventura. I believe it because I see it. I see it in the people I minister with, the people I minister alongside of. I see it in the work that we have done. And I see it not only because of what I have done, but because of what I have needed to hear from you. Not just Dave and Jim and Vern, but what I have heard and seen through Gary, what I've seen through Nick and Brent and Betty and Donna and Lynn, and I've seen through all of these members who have come alongside me. And even though it may have been harsh, they were consistent in what they had to say. And that is, ministry is more important than just any one man or woman. We are a community. That's why I love the word church. It means the body, the assembly. We are in this together. So Esther's response is very beautiful. She finally seems to get the point that she has to do something, anything. She has to say something, and she puts all of her faith in God, that God has done this for a reason, a purpose. And she tells Mordecai, go back and tell all of the Jews to pray. Fast. Go to God. Fast. Be a part of this process with me. And that is what I want to encourage you to do. We see all throughout the Old Testament God responding to his prophets by saying, you merely just speak the words I have spoken and let the change come under God's timing. Let God be in charge of the change. You just be in charge of the words. That if you develop a relationship with God, a rapport with God, where God can look at you and say, I'm disappointed, but yet I have a process for you. That if you go through this process, we will reveal the answer together. That when we are in such situations where hard truth must be spoken, that we can lean on our faith in God, that he put us here for this reason, to speak this message. I cannot tell you how many times I've come away from small groups blessed by something someone has said. They didn't even know they said it. They don't even know what their intentions even could have been, something different, but it's something I needed to hear at that moment. There have been many times, and I'll throw Eileen under the fire because she's done this many times. I will give a sermon that I hated myself. I was bored by it as I was giving it. I thought I had failed completely, but Eileen will come up, she will hug me, saying, it was the best sermon I have ever heard. I don't know if she's lying, but I'm assuming she's telling the truth. There are times that when we speak to each other, we have to believe that God is doing something bigger. That God is speaking truth bigger than what we even intend to say. That God is a part of this process of healing wounds, deeper and further than we can even imagine. that when we come into each other's life, being prepared, knowing what we want to say, we still have to go before God saying, you're in charge. I feel that this needs to be said, and I'll say it, but I know that you're in charge. I pray that they see the heart of God behind what I have to say to them. And that is all that we can do. That is it. And it's so beautiful and simple, yet heartbreaking at the same time, because we still love these people. But again, I ask you, I plead with you, and this is my challenge, is to go on a journey. Go on a journey with them. Go on a journey with the problem. Go on a journey with God and find that solution, not just for them, but for yourself as well. Will you please stand as we continue to worship God?